Alternative historian and author Michael Tazarian is an expert on the occult history of Ireland and America, born in Ireland. He has researched all kinds of mythologies of the world, as well as his own country's magnificent, mysterious Druidic history. Michael's work considers the consequences to civilization of extraterrestrial involvement and answers many of the quandaries that have puzzled other visitation experts. It clarifies the disinformation about Atlantis and the lost continents of prehistory. It shows that the orchestrated chaos of today's world has roots in ancient times. Looking ahead, Michael offers some profound solutions for the future, and he is our very special guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, how are you?
Hello, George. It's nice to be with you. I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. And you got a very, very good reputation amongst various conferences around the United States. You do a lot of those every year, don't you?
Yes. I was at Conspiracy Con, which is just in this May, with Brian Hall, which is a really wonderful event. You know, I'm very happy to do those because, of course, as a younger member of the research community, a lot of the people that are there are my personal heroes. So, you know, whether I'm talking or whether I'm not, I'm just delighted to be there to meet, you know, the gang. And yeah, I was very much, you know, welcomed by them, which was kind of a pleasant surprise. But and then there's another one coming up in August again, the Bay Area UFO Expo. You know, so it's wonderful to be amongst the intelligentsia, the people who have answers to the questions that we all have, you know.
I may get up to that one, by the way, so I may meet you in person.
Yeah, I'd love to, you know, get you to see you. I know that all my friends back in Ireland have wanted me to be on your show, and they're probably listening now. I'm delighted that that's happening, so I have to keep them happy, you know.
Well, Michael, beyond just the personal background info that I just read, tell me a little bit more about you.
Well, my story basically began not with the writing of the book, but when I was about 13 in Ireland. This is in the 70s and 80s, just having questions again, you know, not being satisfied with what we were being told. And especially in my country, I mean, there's the Ireland, there's the Belfast that everyone knows, which is the Belfast of injustice,
right,
and violence and, you know, human degradation and terrorism and violence. And that's been going on, for hundreds and hundreds of years. But there's another Ireland there, and that's the Ireland of the Celts, the Ireland which I describe as a cathedral or a church without walls. I do believe that Ireland, or let's say England, Albion, as it used to be called, is in fact a sacred place. When you're standing on that land, you are in fact on a very special place. In ancient times, it used to even be called the Fortunate Isles, because it was understood by historians that it had withstood, the British Isles had withstood terrible cataclysms. And instead of getting mixed up in, you know, the dysfunction that goes on there, which is apparent everywhere, of course, in Ireland, I tried to investigate that and took myself out into the field to look at this other Ireland that, you know, the megalithic sites and the great structures that are there and the geometric layout of the cities and what have you, and just the lay of the land, and started to really understand that there's an island here that most people who live in the country, you know, don't see. It's funny you should ask me about the conferences and why I do them. One of the actual reasons why is because I had to come away to America to find people here who actually are more interested in the history of my country than my own people are.
Really? Well,
yeah.
You know what? I think you would find that in almost every area. Here's an example. You know, I was born in Detroit, but I spent many years in St. Louis, and we have there, which you're probably familiar with, Michael, the St. Louis Arch. It's a magnificent
Absolutely.
Structure.
Mm-hmm.
But did you know that it's the tourists or people who have moved to St. Louis, most of them have gone up the arch. You can sit in these little cable-type cars, and you kind of go up the arch, and it's a very strange trip. But most people who have done that have come from the outside. Most people who are there, who have been lifelong St. Louisans, haven't even been up in that. And I bet the same as in Ireland or just about any area, that it's the people that are indigenous to that region. Like you say, you got to be from the outside in order to know more about the inside.
Absolutely. You see, apart from a very, very small intellectual coterie that are interested, say, in the Gaelic language, the vast majority of Ireland couldn't care less, you know, about, I mean, okay, you have your folk tradition, but again, it's very neglected. There's no real interest in the depth of the history of what they have, and you come here, or I came here, and bump into, you know, people like Brian Hall, Victoria Jack, Jordan Maxwell, you know, many of the people that you've had as guests,
sure.
they know more about this history, so I'm like thinking, you know, nobody's going to be in the slightest bit interested in what I got to say about Atlantis or the Celts. And I was proved very wrong, because there's people with a very great hunger here to know what is the history of that country, why is it so magical. I mean, historians know that Ireland is the oldest race in Europe, and they must have a story to tell. And when you dig back into the old Celtic legends, they do. But you're right. In Ireland, nobody speaks the language. The language was marginalized, of course, during the British conquests to the west of Ireland, where very few people will speak the language. The music was suppressed, of course. It was forbidden. You know, I mean, there's tourists go there all the time, and, you know, they look at the lovely little cottages, and they think it's also, you know, lovely and quaint, and they think, oh, look at those lovely little windows and doors, and they probably don't realize that the reason why the cottages over there have such small windows is that the British government used to tax the air. So that there was
tax
a tax on
the
breeding.
Air?
How did
they do that?
Yeah, this is the way that the game was run back then. It wasn't because they wanted small windows. It was because, you know, you had a tax that was being imposed on you. So behind the quaintness is a great deal of injustice stretching way back. And as I said, you know, there is another Ireland there, which is this old Celtic Druidic tradition. That is my ancestry, of course, and I wanted to look into that, and that is where my journey started, because then you're going to have some real questions. Even in England, I don't know if any of your listeners are aware that there are these three gigantic zodiacs in England, near Glastonbury, near south of London. There's another one. The lady who discovered this is called Lady Catherine Maltwood.
Maltwood.
Yeah, she discovered a thing called the Somerset Zodiac, which is literally seen from the air, an earthwork, just like your Nazca lines in Peru.
Okay, all right, sure.
These are cyclopean ruins in England. I'm reading about this back in the 70s, and I'm just totally flabbergasted, you know. And then a friend of hers, Mary Kane, discovered a Kingston Zodiac, yet another one of these clearly definable zodiacs, but they can only be seen from the air.
Now, are they etched, Michael, on the ground, or are they built with stone and rock?
Bit of both. They actually etched into the landscape, beautifully done. People can go there and take a tour, and you can see it for themselves. It's a big anomaly, just like there's anomalies all over the world. And then in 1979, I think it was, I came across a book that is that got me really started, and that was a book called The Book of Conquest. It was by a famous artist in Ireland called Jim Fitzpatrick. He is also a designer of albums for bands.
Yes.
But he was a Celtic scholar, George, from... He's still alive. In fact, people can visit his website, jimfitzpatrick.com. He's the guy that basically I owe a lot to, because I read his book, which was the first decent analysis of the Celtic tradition in an appropriate way, in a serious way. What I mean by that is that this man was not treating the old wise folk tales and the magical tradition and the fairy folk thing as that. He was reading through that to see the science underneath it, the great stories, the great saga going on beneath that. His book transformed my life, and in fact, it's curious, because the book that that you have there, my book Atlantis, when I published it this year, I actually wrote to Jim Fitzpatrick and, you know, kind of explained, hey, I'm your fan, and you got me started way back there, you know, 20 years ago, and, you know, could I use your artwork, you know, for the front cover of the book? And he wrote back, and he was lovely, and he said that I could. So the Atlantis book, it's just a great personal, you know, mark for me, was that he let me actually use one of his beautiful pieces of art for the front cover.
Well, I was going to ask you about that cover specifically, the three dark features, ghostly features in the background.
You see that? Yeah.
We'll get into that.
Yeah, hopefully we will, yeah. But it's just a beautiful, you know, accolade, and it was a lovely coming full circle. I'm an astrologer. I love things that cycles have to do with cycles, and just, you know, where I started and then getting the book done. You know, and by the way, I mean, to finish with your point, the question why I go to these conferences, it's more than just being invited there. That book would not exist. I mean, I'm absolutely honest about this. Victoria Jack, who's the lady who puts on the Bay Area UFO Expo down in the Bay Area, she is the one who basically, you know, beat it into my head to do a book. She said, you've got to get this knowledge out, Michael. You've seen the responses of the audience. They love it, you know, and that you got to put this into written form. And I did. And then, you know, it sold, and people like Richard Hoagland were, you know, buying copies and stuff. I couldn't believe it, you know. It's like the great intrigue, and Dr. Roger Lear and a lot of other people are really, really committed to my work because it answers a lot of questions that they have regarding what they're finding in their own world. This makes sense just in the same way that, say, Zachariah Sitchin's work transformed the world.
You've got a lot of support with your theories, and that's going to be fascinating.
And I didn't know that was going to happen. I actually thought the reverse was going to happen, but there you are, you know.
And I've got to ask you this, mainly because you're from Ireland.
Sure.
Do you believe in leprechauns?
Do I believe in leprechauns? The answer to that is yes. Because, you see, again, as we were just saying, behind the veil of the fairy folklore lies a very intriguing story regarding the fairy kingdom, regarding the reason why these beings are supposed to live under the earth.
Uh-huh.
In Scandinavia, you have the king under the mountain. You know, I do believe in it, yeah.
Are they alien beings, or are they earthbound?
I believe that they're very much connected to the earth. They have really nothing to do with anything alien at all,
okay.
In my opinion.
All right, that's another show all by itself.
I'd say so. It's a fascinating subject. There's some interesting research is being done at the moment on that.
How did you, Michael, get interested in Atlantis and that kind of work?
Yeah, that came specifically, it was a little bit because of Jim Fitzpatrick's wonderful books, but mostly I got interested in it because of two people you're probably totally familiar with, and that is C.S. Lewis, the great Christian writer,
sure.
And his great colleague J.R.R. Tolkien. People who haven't heard of Tolkien, say, before last year, have certainly heard of him now because of the Lord of the Rings movie.
Absolutely.
Well, C.S. Lewis actually came from Belfast. He's a fellow Irishman who grew up in Belfast. So, you know, I was reading their work, and I have to tell you that clearly I do not consider those books fiction. I might go out on a limb for some people to say that, but I have never considered those books, the writings of these men, to be fiction. J.R. Tolkien himself used to say repeatedly that his great masterpiece was not an allegory. Well, if something is not an allegory, there's only one way to explain it, and that is because it may be, in fact, true.
Right, and way beyond myth.
Way beyond myth. And I got into Atlantis because of that, and also for one other reason. I am Indian on one side. My mother was from the Himalayas, the northern Himalayas.
I didn't know that. I didn't know.
And what happened is that, you see, I'm caught in the middle of this, situation in which I got this Irish rebel, wild, you know, troublemaking, rebellious one side, and then have this philosophical, yogic, you know, aesthetic.
And you don't have much of a brogue anymore.
Well, if I start yelling at you and start cursing, you'll soon hear it.
Yell you can, curse you can.
then it'll be inexplicable. But then what happened is that, you know, I've got these two sides of myself, and to tell you the truth, what my Indian generation were saying about the history of the world was simply not tying up with what I was being told in school in the West. And I think we've all had that experience. So I then had this quandary, you know, how to resolve what the high cultures of India, the high cultures of Persia are saying about the world, and why we're not being taught this in the Western schools. So this is where my, you know, personal research began, and, you know, I specialize in out-of-print books and
mm-hmm.
archival information. One thing just leads to another, you know, in the incredible chain of life.
Was it like trying to put together for Atlantis pieces of a puzzle? I mean, did you really have to dig for this?
A certain amount of digging is always done, but I think that it's three things. It's the normal, you know, plotting of just researching. Another thing is that there is a lot of information out there already. I mean, you have scholars now, you know, like Zachariah Sitchin, like, you know, Graham Hancock. You have individuals out there in the modern age, and you have plenty of people from previous centuries. I have researched out-of-print books, and all the answers are there. I'm not a person who accepts that a lot of this information, we talk about it as being buried or secret and all of this. I just think that we need to learn how to look in the right place. And the third ingredient is your intuition, your right brain. In any kind of study, we are taught in the West to do micro-specialization, and basically to turn off our intuition and just deal with what, you know, is perceived by the senses and what can be sort of verified in a scientific way. Now, I'm not a scientist, and I believe that science is only one way of looking at the world, an important way, but scientists, as we know, are only verifying what mystics and what philosophers and visionaries have been saying for years, for centuries. So I approach it that way. I have learned a great deal from my own intuition. This is, I think, something that has helped me more than just, say, even the deep reading and the studying and all of that.
Are you convinced, Michael, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Atlantis existed either as a continent, an island, whatever it might have been, but that it was indeed physical and here on this planet?
Yeah, I am personally convinced of that. And I kind of have to be, because even if we go back to Plato and Socrates, you know, Socrates, he said something like, Atlantis has the very great advantage, he said, of being a fact and not a fiction. You know, we have Plato. We have the ancient scholars of Rome. We have Egyptians talking about it. We have, you know, the people in South America. There's not a culture on the face of this earth. Jack Barringer, who's a writer on this, he wrote a book called Past Shock. He says that 30,000, that's the stuff that hasn't been burned yet, 30,000 texts still exist to this day that mention, you know, antediluvian civilizations. And when you study the Celtic record, nothing could be clearer. The ancient Celtic people, my ancestors, speak very specifically about coming to Ireland because four, not one, but four continents had sunk beneath the waves, and they have Gaelic names for those. And they clearly say that they are survivors from a lost, you know, continent.
And was it an advanced group?
So advanced it would boggle the information. And I think this is one of the reasons why it hasn't been taken seriously. The Celtic people, they mentioned four islands, Phalius, Murius, Gorius, and Phineus. And on each of those islands, which made up Atlantis, or the different continents of antiquity.
Almost like the Hawaiian islands are, that make up a whole, right?
Yes.
That kind of thing.
Similar to that. And on each of these different islands, they had a specific sort of compartment of experts. Like on one island would live the mathematicians, on another island would live the herbalists, on another part of Atlantis or these ancient continents would live the
By design they did this?
Yes. To keep things sacred, it was a sort of a way that they had their own little order of things, that the stargazers and the astrologers would live on in one area.
That's fascinating.
The archivists, the people who took care of the writing down of the history, would live on another. It was just this little way that they did it, you know.
Good way to control things as well.
I wouldn't be surprised, yeah.
Do you know whereabouts these islands, this continent, might have been?
Yeah, absolutely. Here's one of the pieces of disinformation. In your opening for me, you definitely said that, you know, one of the benefits of what I do is clear up a lot of disinformation.
Yes.
There's one piece of disinformation or error, and that is that Atlantis is not a continent. Atlantis was a citadel or a city-state, just like London is the city of England, right? But London could have an empire, couldn't it, just like it did?
Absolutely. And Rome.
And Rome, too. Exactly. Good point. And the same thing with Atlantis. Atlantis was not the continent. The continent that Atlantis was on was called Appalachia. It was one of four gigantic continents that have long since disappeared from our Earth. And Atlantis was the city-state or the citadel that was built there by the visitors from another dimension.
All right, when we come right back, Michael, tell us a little bit about where you think that might have been. Of course, as you know, Edgar Cayce believes Atlantis was near the Bimini Islands off the eastern side of the United States. Let's get your take on that and much more, because we're going to get into the alien part of it in a moment. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie here with Michael Tesserion, our guest, his book, Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation. Okay, Michael, before the break, where you were going to tell us where you think the city of Atlantis might have been with those cluster of islands.
Yeah, George, it was definitely on Appalachia, which the science is in now that actually proves where Appalachia was, and it was where a lot of the original scholars said that it was, which is in the Atlantic Ocean, north of the Azores. The Azores was probably very much part of it. The British Isles were certainly part of it. And even where we would now, on a map, see Greenland, Iceland, and even stretching as far up as the Atlantic. Some people say that the continent of Appalachia was so big in the north that basically where Siberia is, you could walk the whole way. You could walk right across the northern, and of course it wasn't tundra, and it wasn't all frozen over. These were very beautiful, temperate climates in those days. And of course, as soon as I say that, it's like the same thing I do when I'm doing talks, you know, people, you know, detract, and they say, no, wait a minute, we've just been finding it under the, you know, Mediterranean, or wait a minute, you know, even Jim Allen has done some fine research. He's looking at Bolivia. And you have different individuals always every, you know, it's a perennial myth. So everybody, you know, in this community will turn over a rock somewhere and say they found Atlantis. Now, I have to be kind of strict about this because I'm very sure of my facts. And that is that they're not finding Atlantis. It's the same old metaphor we were using when we were talking earlier, and that is that just as Britain had an empire, when you have an empire, whether that empire stretches to Delhi or Tierra del Fuego, you will build buildings in the same style, will you not,
right,
as are found in the capital city.
You sure will.
In the headquarters, because your minions, your lackeys are going to rule and officiate from those zones out in what you have as your empire. So what these individuals are finding is not Atlantis proper, but it is the outposts or the various tentacles of the empire of Atlantis in those days. Or they may even be finding something completely separate. Because as I said, Atlantis was not the only pre-diluvian culture or civilization that existed in those times. So again, this is a, you know, controversial piece of information that I give out. I have had many debates with other scholars and we've talked about this. And you see, the evidence is in, actually, because there was a book, if I may mention it.
Yeah, go ahead.
With your permission, there's a book that came out in the 90s by, I believe this is the head of the archaeological or paleoarchaeological faculty in Oxford, and his colleague is the same expert, the dean of, you know, archaeology in Cambridge University, and their names are Allen and Delaire. And they wrote a book called When the Earth Nearly Died. They followed it up in 2000 with a book called Cataclysm. And it has always astonished me, since those books have come out, that there's not been worldwide debate on them, because the science is in. These gentlemen, who are the most illustrious names in these sciences that one could even imagine, even though they come from the Orthodox, you know, enclave,
I understand, yeah,
have absolutely proven the existence of these what the ancient and even some of the more scandalized maverick scholars have been saying about Atlantis. Their book is not on Atlantis, but it contains the science that now can conclude anyone who has a background with Atlantis will find those books, you know, very important. I have large abstracts from their books in my book, and they've certainly helped me. So to me, it was in the North Atlantic.
Now, what time period do you think we're talking about, Michael?
That's a good one. Always is, you know, the jury's kind of always out on that. I would say that the people who created Atlantis, that's these visitors, I have a belief that they arrived here somewhere between 30 and 50,000 years ago. This is where I differ dramatically with Zachariah Sitchin,
mm-hmm.
who pushes the dates strangely way far back.
Okay,
into the past.
But even though you two differ on the dates, are you two talking about similar inhabitants, basically?
We are. He is tracking them mostly from the historical era, which is, you know, the Mesopotamian rise of the great cultures there.
Right.
Of course, he talks about things further back, but he's basically situating these individuals in Mesopotamia and that they have been affecting society from there. I concur with that, as a matter of fact. The only thing on that I may differ, these things are really unimportant in a way, but the one thing that I do differ is the dates. I believe that there's more than enough evidence to prove that these individuals were here much more recently, and between 30 and 50,000 years ago.
Okay, so what do you think? And of course, I can't wait to start talking to you about where you think they came from, but what happened to Atlantis and the continent of Appalachia?
Yeah.
Then?
Let me give you an outline first, and then we can pick from this
okay.
the key point. In my book, I talk about the arrival, because, of course, we're talking about an enormous amount of research and enormous amount of, you know, information.
And you are absolutely convinced what you're about to tell us happened, in your opinion, based on your research.
100%. I'm from a culture, both on my Indian side and on my Ari side, that just wouldn't bother my ass going out there to tell you the truth and telling people things that I was not 100% convinced of, because that is my culture, that's my tradition. It's very important, and all the more important because I am not one who, you know, necessarily buys into the, you know, orthodox structure of education. That doesn't mean that then I'm let off the hook. That, in my book, the antiquarian, the independent scholar, needs to be even more source-orientated, more diligent with his research, because he is now, you know, has the burden of proof in a way.
Okay, all right.
What we're talking about here is that these visitors arrive, and they take refuge on our or earth, and in fact they also take refuge in the earth, under the ground, in caves that were here, which of course the wonderful scholar, who am I thinking of? It's the very energetic Eric von Däniken.
Yes.
Has been doing wonderful research for many decades on the underground caves. But when they arrive here, they precipitated the destruction of the planet that Zechariah is also working on. That planet was called Tiamat. It wasn't a comet that came into our atmosphere. It was actually a planetary body that existed between Mars and Jupiter about 50,000 years ago, and it's not there now. It's the...
Because that's the asteroid belt.
That's the asteroid belt, and that was actually destroyed. It didn't just blow up on its own. That was actually destroyed in this great story that unfolds in the book. And then the visitors came here and settled eventually after the somewhat restored to order, because, of course, you can't have an upheaval like that in our solar system without tremendous after effects. But then they come out onto the surface. They establish their headquarters on Atlantis, Appalachia.
Now, at that time, before they came here, Michael,
yeah,
that region was what? Just an island, a city, just, you know, trees, basically what you'd see out there in the wilderness.
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, Tolkien seems to indicate that it was very much similar to... It's very curious that the people who made the Lord of the Rings movie chose to go to New Zealand, and because that is what Tolkien... He didn't call it Atlantis. He called it Numenor, but he meant Atlantis.
Okay.
The Scandinavian people call it Hyperborea. You know, there's different names for Atlantis, but they talk about it being very similar to Scotland, very similar to Finland, similar in topography to the Scandinavian countries, to Ireland perhaps, and to New Zealand. But it was nothing there, as you know, except the indigenous people of the earth,
mm-hmm,
who are no more, because when these visitors came here, they had a plan for us, or for our ancestors anyway. Well, when some sort of normalcy came to the planet Earth, and these guys are wondering where are they, you know? They came out and they start making contact with the indigenous people that were our true ancestors. And that is where the main action started, because not only did they create Atlantis, they then started to interact with the individuals on our Earth, and they began a very long-lasting genetic hybridization program, which probably lasted many centuries.
Are they what is referred to in the Bible as the sons of man, or are we talking there about angels, fallen angels?
We are talking about the fallen angels.
Okay.
I am absolutely specifically speaking about the Anunnaki, and I am speaking about...
Okay, good. So we can rule that out.
Yeah, and why I use those terms in the book, and why I also use other terms is because, remember, I'm coming at this from what the Celtic records say. Scholars like Zechariah have, you know, focused beautifully on what the Sumerian, Babylonian records have said.
Sure.
There are a few people who have even looked into what the Mayan records have said.
And like you say, they could have been spread out all over the place.
And they were.
Okay.
And the most important thing is, though, I believe, and why my work is so well received, is specifically because of one thing, and that is very few scholars, I mean, I'm talking through hundreds of years, have dealt with this Celtic Gnosis, this archive of wisdom that is in the Celtic tradition, in a serious way, you know, connecting it, dovetailing it in with these theories about visitation. And I couldn't believe why not, because there it is. It's as plain as day if you know what you're reading. In the Arthurian legends, you know, in the whole of the British, the sagas and mythologies of the Celtic race is the secrets of the pre-Diluvian times, the wars of the gods, the coming into our world of evil, the hybridization, the super technologies, it's all there, just like it is in the Babylonian. And I would go so far as to say that it is even a deeper and richer archive of knowledge about this subject. So say a scholar is studying this like crazy, you know, they've got a tremendous fascination into these subjects. If they are not reading and looking at the Celtic thing properly, they are missing out big time, George, because that is where the real secrets are that are actually not found in the Mahabharata, or they're not found in the Eastern legends, and they're not even found in the Babylonian Sumerian record as richly as they are in the Celtic.
Right. Sitchin says that they came here based on his interpretation of the Sumerian text to mine gold for their atmosphere.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on why they came here?
Okay, now we're into something that, again, is a point of contention. Like I say, I agree with a great deal of what he's written, but the thing is, two things. One is that Zachariah Sitchin, for some reason, does not cross-reference a lot of what he's talking about with the comparative mythologies of the world, except for maybe here and there.
No, they're just based on his interpretation of those
right.
texts.
Good point, George. And here's the second part to that. He is also, unfortunately, entrusting his wisdom to the records and the histories that are written by the victors, which means the individuals who started these empires in those days wrote down the histories as they saw it. So that's what we call propaganda.
Early propaganda.
Right. They may be very old to us, and it may be just wonderful to dig up a bunch of, you know, seals and have that incredible, you know, euphoria of being able to decode this and learn about our history. But we must also step back and ask a very important question here. Who wrote that? In my book, in my work, we're talking about that the fact that the great cultures of the Middle East, these ones that were in Mesopotamia, were based on the negative pattern. These were based on the Atlantean paradigm. One of the most contentious things of what I'm talking about is that Atlantis was not this paradisical place which was great, holy, full of holy people, and was wonderful. It's where some of the worst atrocities have taken place because it was colonized by people who had no love for us. And later on, in historical times, these individuals, after the great cataclysms, set up shop again in
okay,
Asia Minor.
So you're saying that we were visited by extraterrestrials who weren't really good people.
No. We, as Carl Sagan has said, as Albert Einstein, as so many scholars out there know and recognize, and of course today we have many people in the UFO research community know this. We even have sightings. We have been visited on this planet probably innumerable times. But I'm only speaking in my book about one specific group of visitors whose agenda wasn't just to come here, do whatever they do, you know, do their research, try not to be seen, as most visitors, you know, don't want to be seen, and then they leave. That is perfectly okay.
What do they look like, Michael? Do they look like what we are now?
Yes, they're humanoid, only they'd probably be taller, and they live a lot longer.
Okay.
But to all intents and purposes, they would look...
They look about the same.
Absolutely humanoid, yeah. This is... I have a lot to say in the book about the appearances and where we go with the reptilian thing, and all of this is explained
okay.
in the book.
Okay, all right. But and still, though, what was their main purpose for coming here?
That's the key thing, and it's one of the things that fascinated me a lot. If you read the Popol Vuh and the ancient scriptures and then into the Celtic legends, you start to see the story. What basically happened was that they were forced, these individuals, and there weren't many of them, they were expelled from their own planetary system, which I happen to believe, you asked earlier about that, I happen to believe that it was Alfred Draconis, but, you know, we could argue about that endlessly. And they ended up being pursued by their expellers. Now, we don't know if those people who were expelling this group of the Nephilim were as bad as they were, or, you know, we're never going to know that. And it's kind of strange. It's probably not appropriate to use pantomime terms like good and evil, because we don't know if the people pursuing were as bad as they were. But the fact is that these individuals that were being pursued ended up in our solar system, and they set up a dummy base on the planet Tiamat, which used to exist between Jupiter and Mars. But they actually came and hid themselves on our planet. And their pursuers destroyed the planet Tiamat, causing the asteroid belt and the first deluge. We have had two major catastrophes within the last 50,000 years that have had the most serious effects on our Earth. And the first one was the famous deluge, and that was precipitated by these beings. It was not a natural event. It was no stray comet just happening to hurtle through our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
That is not what the legends are saying. And if Babylon is saying that, I have questions, because I am very skeptical about reading the histories from the so-called victors who are doctoring their own history in order to make themselves look preeminent.
Okay, now, as they come to this planet, do they have some very nefarious reasons for coming here?
No, I mean, as they say, you know, it's necessity is the mother of invention. I do not believe that these people have anything in common with us in the sense that they would be without what we would call the violet ray. They were without any type of connection to this earth or any kind of morality as we would know it.
Okay.
However, they were extremely scientifically, technologically advanced, more than we can ever imagine.
They came in what numbers?
That is the hard question to answer. Different books say different things. Some say 1,000. In the Book of Enoch, they're talking about a group of 200. Some people are speaking of a council of 13. I would believe that they probably were up between somewhere between 500 and 1,000 visitors.
And I assume they would come here in spacecraft, right?
They were all pursued here in their spacecrafts, and these spacecrafts were also able to go underneath the water, and they were here for a period of time in these spacecrafts, and our Earth ancestors saw them. Many of the ancient records that you read will talk about the, you know, how scared and fascinated and bewildered the Earth people were when they saw the War of the Gods happening in the air.
Next hour, Michael, we'll get into some of the things they did scientifically and technologically.
Oh, good.
But what happened to Atlantis? How did it sink? Where did it go?
That comes after the first part you said. Because of what these individuals started to do, then there came the destructions, which was also precipitated by them. I'd love to talk about that.
So had the destructions, had they not been doing whatever they were doing, it's very possible then that Atlantis might still be around.
Absolutely. In fact, they didn't think of it. They certainly did not want to destroy their own kingdoms and these continents. That had never crossed their mind, and it was not part of the plan. It was actually something that changed the Earth's history forever.
Something went wrong?
Yes.
All right, stay with us, Michael. Michael Tesserian, our guest. We'll be back with him in a moment as we get into his views. A different take, by the way, on Atlantis and what might have happened. Where did those inhabitants actually come from? We're going to find out that, too, because, well, as you just heard, there was another planet, he believes, between Mars and Jupiter that blew up or was blown up. Back in a moment. Michael Tesserian, our guest. Michael, before we get back into Atlantis, you had mentioned a little bit about British history about Atlantis. Did it have anything to do later on with the legends of King Arthur? I've always been curious about that.
Yes, it's interesting that we have the movie coming out. Again, the whole Arthurian legend is
mm-hmm.
well-loved and well-browsed, you know, a perennial study. As a matter of fact, this is what I meant when we first start talking about the importance of the Celtic connection, because the Arthurian tradition is actually based on earlier characters of the Gaelic people in Ireland. They have their Arthur, the Celtic people had Artur.
Artur, same,
yeah.
It's got to be the same person.
Same, similar basis. You have the great sun knight, this knight of the sun, Lancelot.
Mm-hmm.
You have our sun god, Lu. You have Guinevere and Morgan Le Fay in the Arthurian tradition.
Sure.
We have the Morrigan, which was one of the queens of
uh-huh.
Ireland, you know, a warrioress who was married to one of the kings of the high Celtic people.
How about Merlin, the magician?
Yes, this is glad that you brought that up, because that expresses it perfectly. You see, everyone has heard of Merlin, and that's a fascinating character. He is also one of three very powerful Druidic magician types. Two of them. One was Welsh, who was called Taliesin. The bard Taliesin
mm-hmm.
was a person that either predated or was contemporary to the image of Merlin. But way before that, about 5, 6, 7, and I'm being conservative here, 6 or 7 thousand years B.C. in Ireland, the prototype of the Merlin figure was a being called, it's hard to pronounce in Gaelic, it's, let me see if I can try it.
Boy, if you can't, nobody will.
Well, I'm trying to save you that. His name was Avergahain, which is actually pronounced Emergan.
Uh-huh.
It looks, if you're reading it, Emergan, A-M-E-R-G-I-N, but in Gaelic it's Avergahain. Avergahain is the head of our order. He is the druid that was of the high Celts, because the thing to understand is that the Celts are, of course, a huge race. We're talking about an enormous demographic.
Sure.
So when we have to be specific. Within the Celtic people, was their elite, was their magical and royal elite. They were called the Gaelic people.
Mm-hmm.
And they are mostly to be found in Ireland, in the Isle of Man, and in certain parts of northern Scotland. And then within the Gaelic group themselves is yet another division, smaller still, of the real, you know, arch-druids, the very purest and most powerful of all the magicians. And Evergahain was the druid and the bard of that group. So he is the prototype. Now, of this extremely important elite group in Celtic mythology, the king, the high king of Ireland, he had a sword. And that sword, he called it Retaliator. And Retaliator is the sword that is the prototype of the famous Excalibur.
Right.
So there's not a single detail, not even a person, not even a personage within the Arthurian tradition that cannot be tracked back to Ireland and to the original, even the, you know, the Sir Gawain and the Green Giant, the Green Knight. That goes back to a character in Celtic mythology called the Dagda, the all-powerful, the all-father.
Well, are you saying, though, that the Celts were offshoots or offspring of the Atlanteans?
Both the Atlanteans and the Lemurians. One of the other cultures we haven't been speaking about so far was the Lemurian race, who was a contemporary of Atlantis, and they, the Gaelic people are more of a Lemurian stock. But they definitely were hybridized on Atlantis. These beings that we're talking about are descendants of the original being that was the hybridized individual that I describe in the book as Homo Atlantis. We are Homo sapien, and sapiens is a word that just means the intelligent or wise one.
Right.
I just prefer a term in the book for argument's sake as Homo Atlantis, because the being that we are, this individual creature that we are today, that has both alien DNA and human DNA, was actually created on Atlantis by the visitors.
Yeah, so, you know, Sylvia Brown, the psychic, says that I'm a reincarnated Atlantean. And Art Bell, too, she said.
Many people will use that term generically. Many people will use it specifically. I can't speak for, you know, because it's such a generic term. I you know, we're talking about a lot of people's interpretations here, which may be right and may be wrong. I am, again, just a purist who's going straight to an archival source of information for my information.
Okay, now, did I hear you correctly? Did they come from this planet that blew up between Jupiter and Mars, or did they come from a different one?
No, they came from an entirely different solar system. They came from a solar system, I believe, was in Alpha Draconis. And I know, of course, there's been great debate about this. Did they come from the Pleiades? Did they come from Sirius? You know, where on earth did these people come from? To tell you the truth, in my work, that is a much lesser concern. I am more focused on, like Jack Barringer is, about what is the psychological impact on us of this visitation. I am interested, of course, in where they come from, but it's not my foremost interest. My most important interest, as I said, I'm not a scientist. I'm a philosopher. I am very much fascinated with the legacy of this. What kind of impact on the psyche? You know, my book is entirely about the question of evil, the question of injustice, the question of this proclivity that every human being on this planet has within themselves. I don't care if you find it in the halls of government, which we do, unfortunately, but we have it within ourselves, this propensity for immorality, this injustice to, you know, even if it's in a small, petty way, it exists. It's the endless conflict from the time we're born as to whether to be good or to be bad, if you want the most simplistic terms. The age-old question of evil. I personally do not believe that is just a happenstance of nature, the erstwhile movement of nature, you know, flubbing it with its highest creation. Here we are in a universe that is perfect, in absolute balance, from the largest neutron star, right, to the smallest atom, mm-hmm. is in perfect harmony. How can the force, nature, that brings that into existence, then make a big boo-boo with its so-called highest, you know, creation, which is man? I do not believe that nature created this proclivity, which is driving the world to ecocide, which is putting us at each other's throats, which is causing all of the disasters throughout time. I do not believe that nature is responsible for that. I believe that something that has been tinkering and tampering around with nature's laws is responsible for it. I now know what that is.
Do you believe, Michael, that there are remnants of Atlantis somewhere on the bottom of the sea?
Yeah, there are, and as we talked earlier, definitely, we are finding these. And it's the old Indiana Jones situation, you know, we might be shown some of this stuff, and the rest of it might just end up in that big warehouse buried, you know, under the vaults. I would love to go browsing with you into the, you know, underground libraries at the Vatican. I would love to, you know, spend a day and look around under the Oxford University, you know, libraries and what have you. And all the other private libraries, only one-tenth, less than one-tenth of the books that have ever been written are available to you and I and to the rest of the listeners. We have a serious marginalization and sequestering of knowledge, not only by secret societies, but by institutions of learning, so-called, and we are not provided access to these wonderful, you know, records. But my mentors, that is, you know, Commons Beaumont, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, they did. And they realized that they had to get this out to the public, but they couldn't do it in an official way because they would have been censored. So they chose the medium of fiction, what we now call fiction, the high fiction. and they created their great works in order to, and also did the medieval artists. We're talking about art here as well. Some of the finest artists from the medieval period and before and since have portrayed in their art, if you know what you're looking at, incredible information about the pre-Diluvian era and the whole of the conflict that I'm talking about.
Now, can you paint a picture for us, Michael, what Atlantis looked like 30-some thousand years ago and what they were doing there? And also, how long did they exist out there? 10 years, 1,000 years? How long?
Well, I think it could have been as long as 30,000 years.
Of their existence there.
Once these people arrived here, remember our entire solar system was in a state of magnetic upheaval. So there was a long waiting period just for things to calm down. I mean, you don't drive your car willingly through an earthquake, do you? So these characters didn't want to just fly their spaceships back out of the Earth immediately because, you know, and they didn't know where they were. The Schumann waves, the Hartmann waves, the ultraviolet light, the size of the planet. All of the above was probably not what they liked or what was good for them.
You're saying they came here accidentally?
They came here purely accidentally, and they did not. They've never liked it here. They don't like it here. They've never liked it here, and we're living in the times where they're actually going to be trying to get off. But
are they still here?
Well, the descendants are. Yeah.
Well, now that's fascinating.
This is the heart of the book. Because I am not a person that is. I am. Of course, as you can obviously tell, fascinated by ancient history, but my book is not necessarily a treatise on ancient history. I am, as a person, very concerned with our times now, what is going on in our world right now, and I believe, like my mentor Jordan Maxwell has said so many times, that if you want to understand the times that we're living in, or you want to understand the times to come, it is imperative that we understand the foundations, the origins of where we have come from. The 21st century is that time. In the very, very first lines of the book, with your permission, I'd just like to read that.
Please.
Few lines. It says here in the preface of Atlantis that during the next 10 years, the human race is destined to finally discover the facts about its true origins and destiny. As part of this discovery, we have to address the overwhelmingly important question of how the phenomenon of evil came into the world and into the consciousness of Earth's human inhabitants. This is a question that should be on the mind of every living man and woman. It has been with us for millennia, and it will be with the children of the future if we do not come upon an answer now. We have left the question of evil in the hands of the theologians and the scientists for too long. This was surely a mistake, for as the casualty statistics clearly testify, the institutions of religion and science have been the worst purveyors of evil that this planet has ever had to endure. After centuries of prevarication and criminality, we can no longer afford to look to these edifices to answer the all-important conundrum of evil. What we're talking about here, George, is that we have to look to the past in order to understand where we are now, because we are in an end-game DEFCON 1 situation. These beings came here, we're talking about 30,000 years ago. You know as well as I do that that's a blink in history. That's yesterday. So they have tampered with our DNA. They have created a being. They have... either intentionally or non-intentionally, we have now, as a result of their hybridization program.
So you and Sitchin agree on that part?
Oh, yes. And okay. Many other scholars do. Years before Zachariah Sitchin and I were ever born, people have been writing about this. It's part of the occult tradition. It's part of the magical tradition. It's in the Bible. It's in the Book of Enoch. It's in the Pistis Sophia. It's in every scripture. And I've read them all. Every country's holy books or every country's holy scriptures that they consider sacred. I have looked into them, and they're all the same refrain.
That we've been genetically altered.
Absolutely. And, of course, that is the text that still survived, because we also know in the research community that there has been an overt plan to destroy this knowledge. I go into that in the book as well, about the different attempts to sequester and get rid of this information. But somebody's in the know, and we're not going to understand the times that we live in, and all of its strangeness and all of its permutations, both militaristically, sociologically, economically, psychologically, which is the thing that really fascinates me. We're not going to understand any of this unless we address this question of evil. In my mind, coming from a philosophical background, I can't imagine that we've ever had any other question of more importance. Is it not important for us to find out why we do the things that we do, not only to this planet, but to each other?
Well, can't you say the devil made me do it?
Well, I would be wondering to where that image of the devil comes from. Of course, I've looked into that. Religion is a very important, like it says in the preface I just read, we have looked historically, when we want answers to the question of good and evil, we have turned to the religious representatives. But unfortunately, you see, maybe it's my Irish or something, but I think it's time to give them the bloody pink slip, because they haven't done a very good job of explaining it. And in fact, in their job to solve the problem, have they not committed infinite more, you know, acts of terror and criminality and psychological abuse to us? They've contorted the original Sumerian Egyptian story of the book of Genesis in order to denigrate the female. This is what my book also goes into, is about the question of why is it that there's been this campaign of mass murder and marginalization of the female? We got questions there. They're not going to be answered. This is a subtext, a sub-theme to the whole question of the coming of evil and the rising of the great post-historical empires in which were based on patriarchal patterns and which were based on hierarchy and based on conquest, you see. This is the legacy we have inherited from only 11,000 years ago, but the roots of our historical era are to be found in the pre-Diluvian era. And that is why scholars from the Royal Academy and the Royal Societies did not want us to look back, you know, that far. And they just said, oh, that's all fairy folk tale, and we don't want to look at that, and we've had big ice ages. What are you talking about? We've had a 2-million-year Pleistocene epoch, which now we find out through the work of Michael Cremo and others, didn't even exist. You know, they would do anything for us to look back. But as I say in my book, the 21st century is the time for solutions. It is the time for us as the human race to put aside a lot of our, you know, partisan agendas and start looking at who we are, because we are doing incredible injustice, not only to the animals and to the earth, but to each other. And it's building up all the time. It's not just the criminality that's happening socially and politically. It's the day-to-day soft evil that we all commit inside ourselves. Do we want to be lumbered with that? Do we want to be lumbered with that and say that nature is responsible?
Well, are you saying that these people, the Atlanteans, that they were evil from the get-go?
I would use that word, and I use it very... yes, I use that word because I have looked into history and I've seen what has come of their tampering. You see, as I said before, other beings, you know, I don't want to be Gene Roddenberry here, but obviously there is a directive, right, a prime directive in which we, if we have space travel, we go, we research, and we leave. Most of the visitors here have done that. The Nephilim, the fallen angels, these sons of the serpent people that William Bramley gives them the term, the serpent people, they chose not to do that. And if you read the Book of Enoch, it tells you that they were even concerned about
that. But you're not saying the Atlanteans, you said, they'll look like us. So we're not talking about reptilians here.
Oh, no. We can get to that later. That's another big bone of contention I have with some of the scholars out there.
All right.
These individuals were actually frightened. The leader of the Nephilim knew that they were doing a forbidden thing. I don't have it, but it's in the book. There's a passage quoting verbatim from the leader of the Nephilim saying that he's doing an unholy thing and that time and history may never forgive him. And he actually asks his colleagues, can they go ahead with it? Now, biblical researchers have always put that down to the physical mating with the women.
Right.
That is not what they are talking
about. What do you think it is?
They're talking about something much more scientific and much more in-depth. They're talking about the actual interference with the DNA of the human race that they have now visited, their visitors.
Which still could be going on based on some people's abduction testimonies.
If you listen to Dr. Roger Lear's stuff about the implants, if you talk to Dr. Jacobs, you know, I mean, yes, we are aware that this is going on. There's something still happening on our planet. Peter Davenport, I'm sure you know.
Sure.
Has been
quite
looking into this. Yes, we're all looking into this question. And, you know, again, I tend to want to know that I am convinced that the answers to all of what is happening now lie in the records of the past. However, I must restate again, my motive for doing this is not because I got nothing better to do. I am fascinated with what's happening in our times. I'm fascinated about where we, the human race, are going. And we need to be aware that the roots of our modern age right now are, you know, in the distant ages of the past.
Did they have nuclear capabilities in those days?
Yes, in fact, that's a good point. I was just looking through the book, and you know that, remember I told you that part of my ancestry is from India?
Yes.
The head of Sanskrit at University of Madras, who was one of the people who had the incredible job, let's say, of transcribing all those ancient, you know, Sanskrit texts, his name is Dr. Raj Havan. Okay, this is what he has to say about your question. He says, 50 years, he says, of researching this ancient works convinces me that there are living beings on other planets and that they visited the Earth as far back as 4,000 years B.C. There is just a mass of fascinating information about flying machines, even fantastic science fiction weapons, that can be found in the translations of the Vedas, the Indian epics, and the other Sanskrit texts. And we know that the Vedas are very famous. We still have them, right?
Yeah, well, that's what I hear.
Did you know that the Scandinavian Edda, that's the holy books of the Scandinavians, right? It's called the Edda. It's the same word as the Veda, and the story is the same.
It's just the V's taken out, huh?
The V is for pronunciation purposes. They're the holy books, and they actually have the same dramatis personae and the same events taking place in both those
All right, well, it sounds like somebody pushed the nuclear button in those days, Michael. Stay with us. We'll chat with you more about that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George. Well, Michael, okay, now, you've got to explain to me what you think Atlantis looked like during this period 30-some thousand years ago.
That is one of the most fascinating subjects. The Germanic people used to call it Ultima Thule, right? Ultima Thule or Ultima Thule, meaning extreme north. They also positioned it up there. The Celtic people used to call it Hyperborea, and they definitely speak about it being temperate. You know, in the old Superman movies, when you see look what we're looking at here in these Superman movies, a being, right, from another planet with superhuman strength.
Yeah.
When he goes to his particular
place, his refuge, his ice crystal palace, I guess.
Precisely, his particular little oracle, his enclave, which is a supercomputer, is it not? He goes where? He goes into the north. Now, granted, it has ice in it now, but you see, that is another subliminal message there about something that somebody knows about the old mythologies of the northern climes, which were very temperate. You see, before the pole shift, which again was precipitated by the alien presence on our planet, but before the pole shift, we had a straight axis. It was what the geospherical people call tholeiform, in which the axis of the Earth is perfectly straight. That gives us a very temperate climate, especially in the northern climes. And that is what all the ancient books talk about the Blessed Isles, you know, the Fortunate Isles.
Sure.
The fact that it was very lush and temperate. And, of course, if you're visiting here and you have your pick of where to go and you have spacecrafts that can basically comb the whole of the planet, then, you know, they probably had good reason for setting
you
up.
You go to the nice spot.
Why not? You know, I would.
Now, in terms of buildings and things, they come here. How do they start constructing all this?
Okay, that is another key. I have a whole chapter on that one. That is very important because, of course, they were limited in their number. And just like the travelers who were lost in space, literally lost in space, they probably came here in such a hurry, they had to immediately start calibrating where they were, what part of the galactic wing, you know, because their intention was to leave.
Were they fleeing some other place?
Yes, they were fleeing their home planet and hiding out in case they were going to be attacked or destroyed.
Why were they fleeing?
That I don't know. I'm still looking into that. I have some theories that, you know, why this all happened on their planet.
And obviously, they weren't their entire planet. Maybe they were chased off their own planet.
I believe that's clearly mentioned, that they were coming here in a hurry, they were being pursued. And then because they didn't know where they were, they started to build what we know today to be the great megalith.
Well, it's kind of funny. Like you mentioned Superman, they could very well have been like those villains that were chased off their own planet.
I believe it. And in fact, if you even watch the movie Planet of the Apes, if you know what you're looking at in that movie, they're describing Atlantis. You asked about the layout of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say go and even rent that fantastic film. And they're giving you some indication of how Atlantis was laid out so that it would be very easy to, in fact, sequester or corral the indigenous Earth people, you know, the groups that they would bring there. Because they wanted to experiment on them. And before you can do that, you have to set up profiling. You have to diagnose. You've got to take research, you know, and you have to do that benignly.
Sitchin writes that we humans were used as labor, almost slave labor. Is that the case there?
Oh, yes. There's no question in my mind about that. The Bible very much talks about that. The Popol Vuh, for instance, states that as well. And they were able to corral us there and take profiles of our DNA because they were so advanced that even Gene Roddenberry would have difficulty in conceiving of the scientific advancement of these beings. And this is where basically the big problem took place for us. We are now inheriting the schism, the psychic, physiological, genetic, and psychological quandary, the schism, the schizophrenia, that that caused by them splicing their DNA with us. It didn't work, and it has created this remarkable being. The being that they created was a really remarkable entity. Let's make no mistake about that. And I call that being Homo Atlantis. And every single human being walking the planet is descended from that remarkable
being. So that's what we are now.
Yep.
But you're saying it didn't work. What do you mean by that?
It didn't. Well, it didn't work because we have inherited this proclivity for, you know, violence and for injustice.
Okay.
It worked from their point of view originally because all they were doing was wanting slaves. They wanted to, you know, be served.
They wanted little workers everywhere.
You got it. It's the old John Milton Paradise Lost, better to, you know, reign in hell than serve in heaven, you know, philosophy. And they wanted their hot coffee in the morning and, you know, and newspapers brought to them, and they wanted somebody to plow the fields and run the Garden of Eden and whatever, you know. So this is exactly what happened. And if you can change people, and you asked about how they built things, that is how they did an experiment. And the beings that we are, or as put before us, as the Neanderthal individuals.
Right.
These were the individuals who had all the brawn and not too much of the intelligence. And they were the workhorse group. They were all phased out, by the way. One of the great quandaries of paleoarchaeology is that they can't understand where these individuals just went. They know that the Neanderthal race just vanished. Well, of course, you turn them on, you turn them off.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You get them to move the big stones, and you get them to build the calendars, the earth monuments, because, of course, you're lost. So you take some of your experts, and you build these precise monuments so you can do what? Study the heavens, study the rising and the setting of the moon and the sun and the planets, so that you can discover astrophysically where you are. This is what they did. They commissioned the building of the famous megalithic ruins that are scattered all over the world. That is the origin of Stonehenge. That is the origin of Karnak. That is the origin of the Bolivian, you know, ruins. And all over Ireland, this is what I discovered in the field in Ireland, and I surely believe that this was done on purpose. And the Nephilim, one of the translations for the word Nephilim is the watchers. And the word watcher comes from the fact that they were sky watchers. They were watching the sky. They were making precise alignments because their agenda was to up and leave, and they needed to know where they were going.
So they didn't want to stay here forever.
No, they had no intention of staying here a very long time. They were ready to leave. They were just regrouping, and then they were ready to leave. But in the meantime, and of course this was over an extended period of time, and they may have wanted a colony here, they set about the genetic hybridization of the planet in order to have workers, in order to have a slave race. And the original, now this is where the story becomes very interesting, because the being that they created, this Homo Atlantis, he had all the intelligence that his, you know, alien masters had,
mm-hmm.
because he would have been scientifically and intellectually as advanced. But he had something that these individuals did not recognize. Because he had the human DNA, he had also the violet ray. He had the conscience, he had the connection to Mother Earth, and he had something that still, to this day, puzzles them. It's the alien part of us. It's the part, you know, when they say you're cold-blooded or you have whatever, you know, the propensity, and we even talk about people who are, you know, serial killers, of having that incredible conscienceless.
Yes.
That is what these guys are having, and they're looking at these individuals and not even recognizing these other traits that they thought were foibles. They thought this was unnecessary human emotions. But the Homo Atlantis being would not serve their masters. After a certain amount of time on Atlantis, they said, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? You know, why are we having to serve these creatures? We don't even, you know, like them. And to cut a long story short, the beings that they created, the Homo Atlanteans, they leave. They actually pack up and they have an exodus.
Where do they go?
They go to the continent of Oceania, better known to us as Lemuria.
Okay.
And they set up their own thriving high culture on Lemuria and became the opponents, basically, ideologically, of their Atlantean masters, their own fathers. Now, I'm not saying all of them left. I'm cutting this short. But they left and set up their own thriving culture on the continent of Lemuria.
Now, where is that?
That was in where we would call the Pacific Ocean is now.
And that's gone, too.
You bet it's gone.
Sounds like something sinister happened here.
Well, what happened, you were asking about that earlier on, you see, is that the original masters, now they got nobody to bring them their tea and coffee, and, you know, nobody to change the channels for them, you know, and whatever. They suddenly realized, we got to go back to the drawing boards, and they they thought up, you know, what was it that they had done wrong the first time? And they realized that the problem why these servants that they made wouldn't serve them is because they had the centers of higher intelligence. They were mathematicians. They were astronomers. They were computer experts. They were very highly advanced. So they decided that in their Mark II progeny, they would close down artificially. And you can do this in a laboratory with a couple of probes in somebody's head today. Imagine what you can do if you have the power of DNA.
But is that the reason for the Great Flood? Did they truly want to wipe us out?
No, the flood happened without... No, they had no intention of hurting anyone. It just, when they blew up the planet Tiamat, then Tiamat was mostly a watery or ocean planet. And the deluge was the pouring of the effluents through the space of the destruction of Tiamat. And the ancient records talk about this.
And it rained down on us.
It rained down on us. And as even your wonderful scholar here in recent times, I think a couple of decades ago, have you heard of Charles Fort?
Yes.
Well, Charles Fort was one of your finest researchers in this, and he went around even today, in today's world, proving that this effluence often, you see, when the asteroid belt comes close to the Roche field of the planet Earth, some of this effluence will still fall down, and people will be bemused at what is this. But the... When they went back to the drawing boards to do their Mark II being that we call Adamic, the Adamic man, which is also the Eves, was created, these masters decided that they were going to suppress the centers of higher intelligence, which is what they did. And they sent Adam and the Eves into the garden as the workforce. And that is where the euphemism that we use for that dumbing down is naked. It doesn't mean physically naked, it means intellectually naked. These individuals were sent into the garden with less intelligence so that they would be a more perfect servant.
That is fascinating.
It is fascinating. And it goes from there.
How did they push the button? Who pushed that nuclear button?
I'm coming to that. This is one of the most interesting things. Now, you see, imagine that you were, you know, Homo Atlantis, and you were lapping it up over there in Lemuria, but you're intelligent and you're keeping pretty much tabs on your Atlantean masters because you know they're probably going to be up to something after you've left. And then the intelligent ones from Lemuria do in fact discover that their fathers have gone back to the drawing board to create a new, you know, progeny, right? Mark II. And you realize what has been done, that they've had their centers of higher intelligence suppressed, turned off. Now you have a quandary, do you not? Because is it not a fact that Adamic man, dumb as he is he not your cousin? Because he has what you have, he has the human DNA, right? So, to all intents and purposes, you and he share more in common than you do with the alien masters. So the Lemurians had a quandary. Do we allow our cousins to serve these masters that we have escaped from, or do we do something about it? Well, the ancient legends say they chose to do something about it. They sent their representatives into the garden to make contact with the dumbed-down Adams and Eves, to say, hey, know ye not your gods, what we can do, you can do also and more. And if you come with us to where we are, we will, you know...
Sounds like the serpent, right?
It's exactly what they were, because the term that I've been not talking about, that these individuals were also called, was the sons of the serpent. It doesn't mean they look like serpents. There's a reason in the book I explain where that whole thing comes from. But they say, and the ancient legends are, and they all pretty much concur on this, that the Adams, they just couldn't get it. When these individuals from the Sons of the Serpent came into, you know, the Garden of Eden, into the Atlantean compounds or anywhere else in the world to talk to these beings and try to wise them up a bit, the Adams just couldn't get it. But they say, the ancient records do say, that the Eves were very interested.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason,
The Eves were the smart ones.
They say, hey, who are these very comely, very magnetic individuals, you know? And they were the ones who started to listen. And they were the ones who were more accessible to what the Sons of the Serpent were saying. They say, you know, why don't you come with us to Atlantis? And in fact, in many of the talks that I give throughout the world on this, invariably, George, you know, women come over to me in the end and they go, oh, my God, you just told us the story of, you know, the Eves and the Adams. You know, why do we bother taking these dumb Adams with us? Why don't we just bugger off over to Atlantis with the Sons of the Serpent? I say, well, I don't have the answer to that one. But that's exactly what happened. It was the Eves that convinced the Adams, you see, to take of the fruit of the tree. Now, the fruit of the tree is yet another euphemism. The fruit of the tree of good and evil, or the tree of life,
mm-hmm.
is nothing but an old, magical, Kabbalistic euphemism for the DNA. Because that is always what, on through ages and ages and ages, the DNA was shown. It was shown like a tree with 22 branches.
Interesting interpretation.
Yes, it is. It's straight out of the canon of the Kabbalah, of ancient magic, the idea of a tree that has its roots in the earth and has 22 pathways or branches and has the serpent coiling on it, and the fruit of the tree is the knowledge of good and evil, meaning the knowledge of the both sides. So they would be awakened into this by the sons of the serpent if they got to Lemuria. And since the spacecrafts were still working, they were transported through spacecraft, and the records are even so specific. They even mention our ancestors, these Adamic people, talking about leaving the earth and watching the earth go, you know, below them, and it's all there for you.
So, but are you saying that Atlantis and Lemuria blew themselves up?
This is the next part, because when you can imagine that, now imagine, instead of imagining you're a Lemurian, imagine you're one of these Atlantean warlocks. Hey, things ain't been too great since you come here. You've been booted out of your own star system. You come to a planet you don't even like. You make a perfect servant to serve you, and then he doesn't serve you. He takes off and goes to another continent to live. Then you finally make the perfect servant, and he's seduced away. Right?
Yeah.
So three times you've been spited. It is that spite, it is that cuckolding that caused the ire, the wrath, the unspeakable wrath of the Atlantean warlocks on Atlantis. And the result of that wrath is what you've been asking. It was the unleashing of a global thermonuclear war on the Lemurians. Now, the Lemurians responded in kind, and this enormous war took place on our Earth, not more than 13,500 years ago. That's as recent as we're talking
about. And they did it in the form of what? Missiles?
Yep. All that the Mahabharata talks about. I have a statement here for you about from the Celtic legends. Listen to this, George. It talks about, remember that god Lu I was telling you about?
I'll tell you what, hold that until the top of the hour, okay?
No problem.
Back in a moment. Also, we'll open up the phone lines. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Michael Tesserian, our guest. Michael, you're going to read a chapter right before the break.
Oh, yeah, a few lines. You were asking about, you know, how the war was fought, and we were talking about the fact that they had super technologies there.
Mm-hmm.
We know that from Zechariah, but here we have in the Celtic legend something equally, if not more, fascinating. I was speaking about the great wars that the Gaelic people fought, and their sun god, he used to carry around a spear, so-called. Listen to the description of this spear.
Okay.
He also had a magic spear. There's that word magic again, right? If a machine works like so well, it appears to be like magic. So magic is just the ancient people, you know, looking at machinery but thinking it was magic, because these aliens brought such sophisticated hardware,
yes,
with them that, you know, that's what it appeared. So they say he had a magic spear which he had no need to wield himself, for it was alive and thirsted for blood. When battle was near, it was drawn out. Then it roared and struggled against its thongs. Fire flashed from it. It tore through and through the ranks of the enemy, never tired of slaying. Now, what does that sound
like? It's a missile.
Exactly. Listen to this. Here's a chapter from the Mahabharata, just for anyone who hasn't already understood that all the ancient legends contain this information. The Mahabharata says, it was as if the elements had been unleashed. The sun spun round, scorched by the incandescent heat of the weapon. The world reeled in fever. Elephants were set on fire. Horses and war chariots were burned up, and thousands of chariots were destroyed. The corpses of the fallen were mutilated by the terrible heat, so that they no longer looked like human beings. Never before have we seen such a ghastly weapon, and never before have we heard of such a weapon. There's another passage that says, a single projectile, charged with all the power of the universe, an incandescent column of smoke and fire as bright as 10,000 suns. Hostile warriors fell to the earth like trees burned down in a raging fire. You see, all through the legends we have this. How come we haven't heard about this? When Oppenheimer, who is technically considered to be, you know, the father of the atomic bomb.
Exactly.
Well, at Rochester University, no less, a student, an intelligent student, stood up and said, hey, Professor Oppenheimer, the detonation of your bomb at Alamogordo, was that the first nuclear explosion on our planet? That's a very unusual question.
Of course.
But even more interesting is Dr. Oppenheimer's answer. He says, well, yes, in modern times, of course. And that is in the book, and all these quotes I'm reading.
He did not go on to elaborate?
He didn't go on to elaborate. Everybody would have just been shocked. You see, that's what we're talking about. Does somebody know something we don't know? Frederick Soddy, the creator of radium, one of the most important scientists. You know, Herman Oberth, the father of rocketry. The list goes on of the individuals who spoke about this visitation that I'm talking about. I've got all of their statements in the book. From all of the, one of the things that I do, we talked about this in the opening, is sources are very important to me. Because I know that I'm dealing with something that's quite controversial, that is very fringe, that obviously not a lot of people are going to buy into. It has been very important for me then to make sure that I go to the horse's mouth so everything is sourced. If people visit my website, taroscopes.com, look at the links page, go to the Atlantis page, you know, read the book, you will find it is sourced not only with people that we know in the research community, a lot of your guests, but people from antiquity all the way down. The sources are there for people to go and study this themselves. It's very important not to just take my word for it.
Did any of them, Michael, have a chance to escape the planet before this nuclear holocaust?
No. That was, of course, unprecipitated. I think it might have been because they were so recently on the planet that even with their researchers, they didn't know quite how planet Earth was going to respond to this all-out attack. The ancient records talk about how the moisture in the air was completely incinerated.
And see, they didn't expect any of this, did
no.
they?
So, of course, you know, H.G. Wells brings out that in his time machine story, he very specifically tells you that Earth's violence followed man's violence. Right? That Earth reacts with violence over her own, and that is exactly commensurate with what I'm talking about. There has been many upheavals, many sorts of, you know, catastrophes down in the millions of years on this Earth, but I'm speaking about the ones that are in a blink of an eye in a history, very short time ago, and they were precipitated by human beings. They're not to be confused when a geologist comes on and says, oh, but yes, our planet has been visited by so many of these. That's right, it has. But I'm talking about some very specific datable events that have been covered up. But these events took place. There was no way to get out of here. And more importantly for us is that when the Earth is responding, I mean, deluge is one thing, George, right? Deluge is one thing.
Right.
Takes the planet a couple of hundred years to come back to a sense
mm-hmm.
of normalcy.
Mm-hmm.
Pole shift is very different. And pole shift is what you got when the war was unleashed. The Earth responded not just by another sort of deluge, but it reeled off its axis. Now, we're not talking about the pole flipping over. We're talking about a movement of the pole. We're talking about the, you know, we're talking about the...
And did it come back to its original state again?
No,
after?
It swung away from it. It swung away and then came back to where it is presently. And that kind of effect, no deluge. I have the descriptions from all the world scriptures about what that was like because it's written in our DNA. Our own body is the scriptorium in which this event has been written. We're talking about the Eiffel Tower stuck head first, you know, in a plane in Carolina. We're talking about mass extinctions. We're talking about the entire devastation of our Earth and those four great continents of which I'm speaking, Atlantis, Lemuria, Oceania, Terania, Beringia, they're all destroyed, gone forever. So, more importantly is that not only do you have this worldwide cataclysm that took place about 13,500 years ago,
mm-hmm.
which all the modern science, and I'm talking about books that have been written this decade, in the 90s, Robert Milton, Shattering the Myth of Darwin, Alan and Dallaire, When the Earth Nearly Died. These are books confirming what these old legends have said. The time has come to have the answers. I had one of your guests, not one of your guests, but one of your listeners email me before I came on your show. And he was telling me about the kind of guests that have been on your show recently and about how we're just exposing so many of these amazing things that, you know, there's so much exposure now. And that is exactly what I've been saying as an astrologer, that now is the time to come to see what we have gone through in our planet in just recent times.
Well, let's go to some of the calls and remind me to ask you about Edgar Cayce before you're off the air
sure.
with me this hour.
I'll
okay. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
How you guys doing tonight?
Good, good. Go ahead.
I just have one question. Is there a correlation between the history of Atlantis and the higher mysteries of Freemasonry that you've unraveled? I mean,
yeah, what's your
covered?
Name?
Lonnie, L-O-N-N-I-E, Lonnie.
Okay, Lonnie, thanks for your call. That's a very interesting question. Have you got the Atlantis book?
Not yet.
It's interesting because you're almost speaking about what it's about. I have been a lifelong student of secret societies and fraternal orders. I work very closely with Jordan Maxwell. I work very closely with Ted St. Rain of Lost Arts Media, and we with other specialists in this subject. There is definitely a connection in many ways. I mean, more than we can go into in this one show. One of the ones that comes to mind, of course, is the fact that the people who, remember I was talking about how the Nephilim were the great designers and builders of the great monuments and so forth and so on? Who do you think was their descendants of that knowledge? That's one connection. The second connection is, remember I was talking about the sequestering of the books, which is why we have to have, you know, coast to coast, and the few shows in the world, the few books, the few scholars that are left that even may go into this at their own peril. Why is that a situation? How come this is not something that, you know, we've known for hundreds of years? Why is it not in the open? Again.
Suppressed.
Suppressed. Secret societies who are the progeny of these Atlanteans coming out of the dynasties, the bloodthirsty, conquestative, agricultural, patriarchal, hierarchical dynasties of the Middle East have now basically owning and controlling the world. If you imply new world order, in my book, doesn't that mean, in my mind, doesn't that mean old world disorder?
Probably.
Right? See, we're being told something here. And these fraternal orders definitely do preserve the secrets of what we're talking about. And the last chapters of the Atlantis book go into the role that these secret societies have played. I go into the documents of the Knights Templars. I go into the documents of the Freemasons and the Knights of Columbus and the Knights of Malta and all of these organizations that exist on the planet. I've researched them thoroughly, and you will find a lot of information there, Lonnie, for you to get an answer to that more than we can do justice here today.
And you believe they're all tied into the Atlanteans?
Well, that's a very general statement because, remember, I do not believe that any organization in itself is negative. I think that these guilds, these bastions of, were once very sacred. They were probably great centers of learning. And many Freemasons, I'm not talking about your street-level Freemason, I'm talking about bloodline Freemasons.
Understand.
You know, if we get into the whole question of Freemasonry, we have to be very, very specific. That's why I keep referring you back to the book, Lonnie, because I don't want to make general broad statements here. Freemasonry originally was a very sacred order. I mean, you have the Duke of Brunswick, you have George Washington, talking about that it has been infiltrated in the 17th century. The heads of the World Order of Freemasonry are standing up and telling people. Madame Blavatsky, you know, went blue in the face warning people that Freemasonry and these orders are being taken over from within by a group called the Bavarian Illuminati coming out of Germany. And there was an insinuation through the Grand Lodges of France, through Grand Orient Freemasonry, came in this more pernicious element that now dominates today. And if you read the memoirs of George Washington, it's all there. I have the quotes from George Washington confirming this, that this was happening in the 1700s.
West of the Rockies, your turn. You're on with Michael Tesserian. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Michael.
Hello there.
For one thing, I'd like to say I'm glad that you're in the Seattle area, because if you have any talks or anything that you're going to do, it'll be easier for me to get to them.
We're doing them all the time, love, so you know,
wonderful.
You're welcome to come over.
Wonderful. I was wondering, do you think that the church and the British Empire suppressed the Gaelic language because some of the stories that were passed down in Gaelic could have exposed some of the things that they were trying to hide? And also, what do you think of the Aran Islands, Galway, and Roscommon as an area for ancient artifacts?
Yeah, ancient artifacts, the whole country is riddled with them, and the area you're talking about is very much like that. The reasons, one of the things that I focused on when I was looking at the suppression aspect, you're talking about the suppression of, say, the British government, especially during the, you know, the earlier centuries, and the suppression of the words and the Gaelic language. Of course, because that language, like Sanskrit, is a sacred language. And, of course, you don't want anyone to know that the Celtic people and the Gaelic tribes were matriarchal. Right? You're going to do some suppression just to get rid of that. You don't want to say that Tara, right, was where the three queens sat. Right? You don't want to talk about the fact that the Gaelic kings had consorts. You don't want to talk about the fact that Ireland, all the names of Ireland are named after the goddesses of that country. They don't want you to know that the warriors, the warrioresses of Ireland are what turned back the whole power of the Roman army. Here we're talking about a Roman army that would come so far into England, right, into the west, and then suddenly, you know, take a boat, go over to Ireland, and then just turn around and leave and not bother conquering Ireland. You don't think there's a reason for that? Read the memoirs of the literate Roman soldiers, and they'll tell you what they saw. They don't want you to know that. They don't want you to know that the Celtic queens over there used to have a statement. You know, they had a quote, better to die three times in battle than to bear one child.
Oh, my God.
Right? This is the kind of fierceness and the pride and the power that the women had in that country, which was a matriarchal country. The symbol of our country is three spirals, right? The three triple goddess, the triple goddess. the fact that Tara sits on a mound, a hill, the fact that the goddesses that are of the tribe that I was talking to about were feminine, this was one of the reasons why it had to be suppressed, because that is betrayed in the language, that is betrayed in the folk tradition, and that had to go, because you cannot, as you said, yes, the Vatican is very much responsible for this. All the patriarchal Atlantean paradigm bastions and dynasties could not have the matriarchs or the oracles, you see, or any of the shamanistic or Gnostic tradition operating in the world. That was first and foremost had to be deleted.
Michael, do you think it was good or bad luck that they came to this planet?
That is connected to more of the philosophical. As I said to you earlier, I come from more of a philosophical, metaphysical background, especially on the Indian side. And that ties in, George, with a whole question, a metaphysical question of why. Nothing happens by accident.
I agree.
If this kind of evil has come here, it is part of the destiny, let's say the karma, to use an Indian term, of the people that are here. We have to deal with this because it is a reflection of something that is happening inside of us. Nothing happens in the external world if it is not a manifestation of something on the inner psychological plane. But that, again, you know, takes us off into another whole debate.
Next up, first-time caller line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
It's an honor. And preliminaries, I must say, we all love you. You're great, just like that guy said. You sound just like the guy down the street, and you're excellent. And Michael, you're brilliant. Love your research. I want to ask you something about Krishna, about aliens and stuff, and, you know, him being blue and everything, and just, you know, the attractor of souls, which he is. I'm very familiar with that experience. I was wondering about your feelings about that and the whole Vedic thing and the Aryans, you know, where they might have come from and everything, because, I wondered about all that stuff, you know, the whole thing with that. And so what's your feelings on it?
Again, you're dealing with a sun god. You're basically, if you strip it down, you're dealing with a nature god, right, a deity. Mm-hmm. That has tremendous powers. Mm-hmm. There is definitely a connection. Remember we were talking about diffusionism, how one myth spreads across the world?
Right.
And how different people study it. You're into Krishna worship. I would suggest to you, since we have such a short time, is that there is a definite connection between the image and the word Krishna and the word Christ.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
Right. And then there's also a tie-in to the Arthurian Celtic tradition. There is a knight. You may have, if you've read the Arthurian tradition, there is a knight, a very famous knight, by the name of Sir Tristram, or Tristan, right?
Yes.
If you get into the etymology, you will find that as Krishna played the flute, so Sir Tristan played the harp. As Krishna would go amongst the shepherds and go amongst the maidens and play his musical instrument,
mm-hmm.
so would Sir Tristan go amongst the shepherds and play his harp. Check into the tie-in of the evil uncle of Lord Krishna and the evil uncle of Sir Tristan and connect these three personages. You know, there's a whole line of research there about the connections between Sir Tristram, Jesus Christ, and Krishna. And a very interesting story unfolds there. If you contact me, we can go into this. This is a fascinating subject there.
Yeah, it's all like organ. It's all like DNA stuff as far as these myths. It's like this earth and organ, and all this stuff just keeps swimming around. Wow, it's amazing. Wow, excellent. Thanks a lot. And
you're welcome.
Keep it up, you guys. Take care.
You're welcome.
Bye.
The Edgar Cayce quick question before we go back to more calls and then the split at the half here. But was Edgar Cayce very right on with his thoughts about all this?
Yes, Edgar Cayce was right on about a very great many things. He was a very special man. And he, of course, was one of the people who, in this country, in America, you see, you've had some very fine scholars who, without them, without Edgar Cayce, without Ignatius Donnelly, without Charles Berlitz, without Charles Fort, we would not be even probably studying these subjects anymore. Because okay, we have our old scholars and the old world scholars, but then in America, look what has happened. The country's young. Barely 200 years old, and what already starts happening?
Legend, by the way, legend had it that Tristan was playing his harp the night you were talking about,
mm-hmm.
when he was killed with a dagger or lance from the back. Someone stabbed him.
Is that interesting?
Sure is.
The harp is a very powerful instrument. That's the symbol of King David. People asking, how come, they think it's an Irish harp that they see on the Irish flag. No, it isn't. That is a Hebrew Semitic harp from the Middle East.
Stay with us. We'll be back with the rest of your questions right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Hey, Michael, do you believe in the hollowed earth theory?
Yes. I have both on the Atlantis book a lot of information on hollow earth, and also I have produced a DVD that's at least 10 hours on the same subject, and we go much more extensively into the whole phenomenon of hollow earth in the DVD version of the Atlantis book. And it's something that is one must know about and factor into all of this, not only into the original arrival of the Nephilim, but how it fits in now. You know, I mean, John Rhodes is a scholar who's looked into that, and it's definitely a piece of this whole puzzle.
It's just amazing to imagine what happened on this planet a long time ago.
Yeah, and the thing is that we're still reeling from the shock. There's even some scholars, some scientists, who believe that the Earth is actually not recovering from the original pole shift, because we have such short life spans ourselves as human beings,
mm-hmm.
we're not privy to the fact that the Earth, by the way, is still reeling from the shock. It didn't get over it. It's still there, and the Schumann waves and the Hartmann waves have been affected. And some people are actually saying that the planet is dying because of the original trauma of the pole shift that happened about 13,000 years ago. I don't know what to believe myself on that. I'm looking into it.
Wildcard line, your turn. You're on with Michael Tesserian. Hi there.
Yes, this is Margaret from Amarillo.
Oh, Margaret.
And thank you so much for the beautiful programs you have.
You're welcome.
And especially tonight. And I wanted to talk to Michael that I have been meditating for about the last 40 years. And my guide has taught me, and I have been led back to relive my lifetimes from the time that the DNA was brought into this universe. And what I have relived corresponds to what, Michael, you're saying exactly.
Thank you, love. I'm just listening to that accent, so just keep on talking. It's just great. I wasn't listening to what you were saying. It's more the way you're saying it. Thank you for your call, Margaret. Yeah, this is, of course, the beauty of when you are a purist. And as I said earlier on, when you are using your intuition, it never fails you. And when you then corroborate that, I'm not a person who's trying to, you know, make facts, just create, you know, theories out of nowhere. I'm looking at the facts. And then these, it's like the deductive process, you know, that Conan Doyle in his great Sherlock Holmes stories, that every single detective in this world, I don't care, or any policeman, they do what we do. You can do a kind of psychic archaeology. You can do a kind of intuitive relic hunting. You can take the pieces and then you can deduce, okay, this fits to this and this fits to this. And you can do it from the armchair. There's kinds of people in this world that need to go out and turn over stones, you know, in the middle of the Syrian desert. And then there's just people who can piece this together intellectually in their head, you know. And it's great, Margaret, that, you know, you're able to do that and you're getting from within, because the oracle within is the most important reservoir of knowledge that we have, and it cannot match any findings that you have outside.
Excellent. Margaret, thank you so much for that phone call. Appreciate it. Let's go west of the Rockies. It's your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, this is Dan from Phoenix. Hey, I had a question for Michael, but before I get to the question, I'd first like to say something that echoes, I finally understood with something Michael said earlier as to why I like this Coast to Coast show so much. And that is because, just as in what happened tonight, with the question I came up with, was what I've found with Coast to Coast throughout the 2 or 3 years of listening is that I hear little bits and pieces from all the different guests.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start putting, or you start connecting little bits of information from one guest to another guest, and so on, you start to see patterns and the puzzle starts to go together. And so with that, my question for Michael is another puzzle that he brought up when he was talking about the genetic altering of the humans. I believe he said 13,500 years ago. I saw a show on Discovery, I believe it was about a year and a half ago, and they were showing the migration of, I think it was the Neanderthals up into Europe, close somewhere around the last ice age.
Right.
And what they had concluded through science and DNA, I don't know how they would do this, but I believe what I heard was 13,000 years. But what they had said was that when a man and a woman have a child, there's one specific gene that only transfers from the female into the child. And what they had found was that there was this one area about 13,000 years ago through looking through, I believe it was genetics, I'm not sure, but that's what I think they said. But they said at about 13,000 years ago, it looked like an hourglass closing, and then it opened up again, and they were perplexed as to explaining why, it was almost as if there was a mass population decrease, and then everyone stemmed off from a small group of people. And I thought that sounded a lot like what Michael was talking
mm-hmm,
about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, Dan. Every point you're talking about is relevant. The mitochondrial DNA and RNA is inherited from the female side. This is very important. The second thing is that we're going to have to do what you're doing, and that is do a lot of research to find out the truth about DNA, because the way it's usually being portrayed to us as this sort of clunking Lego set in hyperspace is not what it is. DNA is nothing more than energy. And we have to understand that the Knights Templar in England were controlling Francis Crick. The researches that were done in Rosslyn University, down the street from Rosslyn Chapel, we have no guesses who controls that. So even the little bit of information that we've been receiving, we're going to have to dig deeper than that to actually find out what DNA really is, because we're not being given the truth. The most interesting thing you said earlier on is something I do teach, and that is pattern recognition. Jordan Maxwell calls it pattern recognition. I call it symbol literacy. It is very important to get out of this habit that we have in the West of microscopic, specialization. Micro-specialization is the bane. That is why we are not being able to see the cover of the lid of the box of history or of anything. You know, sometimes we can be standing too close to the canvas of life. Sometimes we can be standing too far back. All of life is about finding the proper perspective where you can see the detail and you can also see the canvas, so you never lose sight of the bigger picture of where you fit into the matrix. And that requires holism, whole brain thinking, using what we call pattern recognition, noticing the synarchy, noticing the serendipity, the symbolism around you is very important. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to piece together all of these things. It's not going to be left brain thought that's going to come across these great secrets. It's going to be a type of gestalt thinking that is necessary. That's fundamental.
Why do you say in your book that within the next 10 years we're going to discover these facts? What will happen?
Yeah, I am saying that as an astrologer. Most of the work that I do in the world involves the hermetic arts of divination and astrology specifically, and the first line that you read there is a tie-in from the astrological world. It is very clear to astrologers, and I don't care what kind of astrology you're doing, most of us astrologers will agree, that there is something going on. Even if you look into the Mayan record, I'm producing a DVD right now called 2012, Where History Ends, which is a thorough look at the whole of the Mayan so-called prophecy of 2012. And
that's another show, too, for us, Michael.
Yeah, we can
you
do
that.
And the DVD will be ready pretty soon. This is another fantastic discovery. But it's not just them. It's not just the Maya. And by the way, if you get into it, you'll find that the original Maya scholars, people like Sir William Niven,
yes,
and Augustus Laplanjean, they have proven that there are civilizations in Mexico that reach back 50,000 years ago. The Maya are by no means the creators of those astrological and mathematical systems that they're using.
They were helped, huh?
Oh, yeah, they inherited it. But back to the point is that, what was the point?
Well, we were talking about the possibility of these past civilizations and,
yeah,
their tie-ins, yeah, with so many others.
And the next 10 years. There are many cultures that are talking about an end date. Okay, let's keep it with the Maya. The Maya are talking about 2012. Remote viewers report that they can't see past that. Even the Maya, who had a prophecy for every single year of their great years, don't have any prophecy really for the period after 2012. So that can be considered an end by date. And in my astrological work, I've also found the same, that the alignments that are coming there, possibly a phenomenon known as the photon belt, there's going to be something happening on our planet that is going to help us come to end the particular cycle that we've been under since the visitation of the Nephilim. And that's good, except for one thing. The Nephilim, or let's say the descendants of the Nephilim, the people we've been talking about, they know that too. So they're busy now trying to move. And in the last chapters of the book, I go into what their latest machinations are and how they're going to try and circumvent, you know, that particular action of nature coming in. Whether it's an astrological alignment, Richard Hoagland has some interesting pieces of this he was talking to me about recently. We're pulling something together, and we're trying to find out what it could be. Whatever kind of conclusion it is, the other power in this world don't want that to happen. So they're circumventing it, and has a lot to do with the reason why the troops are in Iraq and what's going on in the Middle East, and why we have returned to the cradle of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Does it really have to do with oil and big money? Well, wait a minute. These people we're talking about have been billionaires from the first centuries A.D. Maybe that oil and that money takes care of their lower minions, but are we really seriously saying that the people who've controlled the world for millennia upon millennia are hungry after oil? Is there perhaps another reason why they're there in the sands of Iraq? Because what is Iraq? What is Baghdad? What is Persia? Is it not the center of the places where they first came from, where our post-flood empires have come from? We better read through the symbolism. We better ask some questions. Why the robberies? Why the looting of those museums over there that the people have just rolled over and forgot about? I'm very interested in that. Why the looting of these artifacts?
And where are they now?
And where are they? And why were they taken? And by whom were they taken? And I go into this on the DVD that I'm doing. I'm not doing a book on it. It's just going to be a DVD on 2012. And I just recently did a talk on that in Berkeley, California. It was really wonderful. Ken Jenkins, the great videographer, he was there. And we had a great day. And talking about this whole thing, you know, and people can contact me if they want more information
okay.
about that.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Morning, Mr. Norrie.
Yes, sir.
My name's John. I'm calling from Indianapolis. And I had a question for Michael. It's actually kind of a two-part question, and I'll hang up as soon as I ask.
You got it.
The first one is, you said that the Celts were kind of a hybrid between the Atlanteans and the Lemurians. Could you expand on that a little bit? Were they directly hybrid between those two people, or the second generation of slaves and Lemurians? Or, and could you also explain who the, some books call them the Fomorians, and some books the Ferborg.
Well.
And the fair ones were when the Irish, or when the Celts first settled in Ireland. And I'll hang up now.
Okay, a couple minutes to respond to
that. Well, John obviously knows his stuff. He's talking about a lot of different things there. The quick answer is that we're all a mixture of Lemurian Atlantean, with some people obviously, like there is on any scheme, being more of the Atlantean, pure, you know, and some are more towards the Lemurian. I get into all of this in the book, and especially the people he's talking about, the Ferborg and the Fomorian race. It's a very interesting topic that I'm amazed that he's obviously done his research. He knows what he's talking about. So that's in the book. We go into a great deal of that about the ancient races and how they figure in.
First time caller line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Keith from Pearl City, Hawaii.
Okay, welcome, Keith.
How you doing?
Good.
I have a quick question for you, and then another one for Michael. Michael,
sure.
You just stole some of my thunder. I was going to bring up the museums in Iraq and those things, but you beat me to it by a couple minutes here.
Well, remember, Keith, it's not new.
Yeah, I know, but you don't hear a lot of people questioning what's going on with why the museums are robbed. You don't hear hardly anybody bringing that up.
Well, see, I was just spending some time a couple of weeks ago with Anthony J. Hilder, who you must know, you know, who lived a lot of his time in Africa. We just did a video together called 9/11, The Greatest Story Ever Sold. And one of the conversations we had with him is he is an expert on the raping of Africa, another incredible part of this that has never been gone into. You see, we are not people who understand the occult history of our own countries. America has an occult history that very few people know about. Ireland has an occult history that very few people know about. When I, you know, it's all my literature and it says they're, expert or authority on the occult history of Ireland, that's only because nobody else in the country is even interested in what I'm doing.
Actually, there's been a few.
There's been one or two, as you know, but
there's
it's like
you.
We can't get the subject started. You know, it's like, come on. All of these countries have an alternative history that we need to look at. I mean, I don't have to tell you, you know, Keith, that the study of history as it's taught to us in school is certainly the one of the most boring subjects anybody could ever hope to learn. But as we know in the research community, the study of how the subject of history has been manipulated, that is a very interesting subject.
Oh, yes, I know. I've been studying it for 15, 20 years
right
now.
Very
I have
good
a quick question for George.
Okay, we only got about 40 seconds left, Keith.
Okay, you know who William Cooper is.
Yes.
Okay. And David Icke, one of his newest books, he dedicates it to William Cooper, who died in the World Trade Center. Is it the same William Cooper?
No. That William Cooper. Oh, you mean the dedication? I don't know about the dedication.
Yeah,
but
it's in the very front.
But the other William Cooper, of course, died during a gun battle with
right
some sheriff's departments.
On his own land.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't even know how he died and why I haven't heard from him in so long now. I know.
Yep.
Thank
okay
you, Keith.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. We are wrapping it up, Michael Tazarian. I appreciate you being on the program. Very quickly, would you give out your P.O. Box for those who do not have computers to get to your website?
Thank you for that. It's just Atlantis Book, P.O. Box 95398, Seattle, Washington. Zip code is 98145, / 2398. The website is Taroscopes, plural with one T, taroscopes.com. Just browse it, go to the Atlantis page. All the information you need is there. There is a phone number, which is 206-527-2968.
Very
2968.
Good. All of that linked up with coasttocoastam.com. Michael, thank you. Next time.
George, it's been a wonderful pleasure. Thank you so much for your
absolutely
time.
Absolutely.